I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Last week, President Biden made good on a campaign promise to provide federal student debt relief, up to $20,000 for those who are Pell Grant recipients and $10,000 for other recipients. There are income limits for borrowers to get the benefit, up to $125,000 for individuals and $250,000 for married couples. The administration predicts that 43 million people could have their loan payments reduced and 20 million could have their payments completely forgiven. Here's what Biden said last Wednesday when he announced the plan.
All this means people can start finally crawl out from under that mountain of debt, to get on top of their rent and their utilities, to finally think about buying a home or starting a family or starting a business. And by the way, when this happens, the whole economy is better off.
Biden was criticized from the left and the right. The cuts were too big. They were too small. They were unfair to those who had paid off their college debt. They were inflationary. Biden had exceeded his authority. Well, today in Radio Times, making sense of all those numbers, how this program is supposed to work, why the cost of higher education keeps getting more expensive, and is it worth it? We have two guests who have joined us. Ron Lieber joins us from by Skype, I should say, New York Times, your money columnist, and his most recent book is titled The Price You Pay for College, an entirely new roadmap for the biggest financial decision your family will ever make. Ron Lieber, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And also with us is Danielle Douglas Gabriel. She's national higher education reporter for The Washington Post. She covers college affordability, accountability, and state and federal financial aid policy. And Danielle Douglas Gabriel, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Let me begin with a kind of global question. And Ron, I'll begin with you. How big a deal is this?
It's a pretty big deal. I mean, we're talking potentially tens of millions of people getting a, you know, low five-figure amount of debt canceled. So, you know, there is the impact to people's net worth, but there's also the mental load that's reduced by seeing that number go down. And for a not small number of people, millions of people, there will be no more student loan debt in their lives.
And following up on that, Danielle, the cumulative federal student loan debt in this country is now something like $1.6 trillion. That is a lot of money.
Yes, it is quite a bit of money. And certainly the majority of it really started to increase after the Great Recession, when you saw a lot of people returning to higher education in order to sharpen their skills or fleeing to higher education because the job market was so bad. And we saw an increase in people attending college as well as borrowing to pay for it.
You interviewed a number of people, Gabrielle, for the Washington Post today, and you had some profiles in the paper, and a mixed bag. And these are people who have borrowed money to pay for education. What was the range of response?
Well, I really wanted to get a diversity of opinion. And so I certainly interviewed folks who are at the beginning of their borrowing career. One young lady who's 18, who is a rising sophomore, and she will benefit from this action, but she'll likely have to continue to borrow. So she kind of had mixed feelings about it, was concerned about what her future would look like and that of other people who didn't have resources, much like she didn't when she was applying to school. And then also some folks who borrowed quite a bit of money for a education at a public university and was not so thrilled with this policy, in part because of questions of fairness and questions of personal responsibilities. One young lady I spoke with just thought that, you know, she was fully aware of what her obligation was going to be when she took out the loan, so she doesn't need anybody to foot the bill for her. And, you know, I found someone else who actually had just paid off their loans, the mayor of Richmond, Virginia, that is. And he was thrilled for everyone who would receive relief because he said that no one should have to go through what I went through in order to try to pay off this debt.
Well, that tells you, Ron, I mean, the range of reaction to this announcement last week really covers the gamut.
It really does. It, you know, it's all over the map. And, I heard from one young man, still an undergraduate, who had been hustling hard, right, working three jobs on top of a full-time course load because he wanted to avoid debt in the first place. He is a first-generation American, first-generation college student, and was sort of baffled by how it is that we got to this place. It just didn't make any sense to him that, you know, he had hustled so hard and people who, you know, maybe hadn't done as much paid work on the side as he has were somehow going to benefit. And, you know, this reflects a larger theme that I hear, particularly from parents of college-age children, parents who were born someplace other than the United States, moved here as adults, and they find our overall system for financing college education completely baffling and basically bonkers.
Well, and I want to pick up on all of that, but let me just make sure that we all understand what the Biden administration is proposing. If I can go back to you, Danielle, when we talk about people who have taken out a federal student loan, and that's not everybody, obviously, what is the typical loan? What is the interest payment? Who is there a sort of typical borrower that would help us understand who this person is or who these people are?
Sure. So more than half of the federal student loan portfolio borrowing population has less than $20,000 in student loans. There are about 8% who have over six figures in debt. And those tend to be folks who have advanced degrees that tend to be quite expensive. And also the loan type for those degrees are a bit different. So grad plus loans have higher interest rates, often over 6%. They also you can borrow up to the full cost of attendance. Whereas for undergraduate loans, the government caps how much students can borrow from one year to the next. So on average, you can't take out any more than, I think, $31,000 by the end of your term. For a lot of students, that's as much as they'll ever take out. But many others have their parents having to borrow on their behalf. And parent plus loans, very similar to grad plus loans in that the interest rates are higher, in that you can borrow the full cost of attendance. So we're seeing a lot of older borrowers in that portfolio. Some people, again, who had went back during the Great Recession to sharpen their skills, and then others who are parents who are carrying this debt load for their children.
Well, Ron, in preparation for the show, I'm reading a number of stories of people that had gotten into debt. It often was the interest that really got them into trouble rather than just the what they owed on their loan.
Yeah, this is a thing that happens. So if you graduate from a program or if you don't graduate, there is a large subset of the people that we're talking about here who got into debt to start a program of some sort or another and then did not finish, right? So at that point, you're not getting the income boost from the credential or the degree that you sought, but you still have the burden of the debt. And if your income is low enough, you know, you may qualify for what's known as an income-driven repayment program. But if you're making a small payment or no payment at all, what happens is that interest just grows and grows and grows, right? Because you're not even, you know, putting a dent in what you owe. And in effect, the interest grows on top of the interest each month such that your balance increases. It doesn't decrease, even though you're filling the terms. Yeah.
Well, and picking up on that and going back to you, Danielle, one of the people that you profiled, a woman named Ava Stevens, she's $200,000 in debt. And she said, while I think $10,000 is significant, it's certainly not enough. When I look at the way our government bails out industries, they have lobbying power, borrowers do not. And that she goes on to say that it really was the interest rate. And she had all sorts of, there were medical problems at home that really made it impossible for her to pay back this loan. But nonetheless, it was the interest payments that really buried her in debt.
Yeah, I mean, for one, she had grad plus loans, so higher interest rate to start. Plus, because she was deferring her loans so often and going in and out of forbearance during the course of her repayment, she encountered interest capitalization, where you end up having the interest at the end of your forbearance tacked onto the principal. So then you're paying interest on top of interest. And that allowed for her loans to balloon to what they are right now.
I mean, $10,000 would make another $90,000. That's still just, you know, extraordinary amount to try to figure out how to pay back.
Yeah, especially as you're approaching retirement. And I think that's something that I really hope that folks understand, that while a lot of this discussion has been framed as helping the younger generation, there are a lot of borrowers who are 40 and over, some 60 and over, some 70, who are still dealing with student loans. That is, it is a common issue for folks who are approaching what should be their retirement age.
Ron, picking up at something you said about getting debt but no diploma, and that I believe is within 6 years. I was reading this, and like 40% of people who owe for their loan did not get that diploma. Do I have that number right?
Yeah, it is a significantly large minority of the overall population of borrowers who do not complete the program that they start. And it's tempting to point, you know, a finger at them and say, well, you know, why didn't you finish what you started? We forget that many or maybe even most of those people are in a situation where the program is not affordable in the first place. And that's why they borrowed, right? And so, you know, to point the finger at those folks and say they must have done something wrong is, I think, to miss the point. Also, there are all sorts of programs, for-profit programs in particular, that don't do a particularly good job of bringing people along, particularly low-income first-generation students, and putting the programs in place to make sure that they get to the end and get the income boost that they seek. Right. And so there's all this conversation out there about, you know, who's quote unquote deserving or whether we're pointing the relief at the right people. You know, to my mind, the folks who started but were not able to finish are among the most sympathetic folks out there.
Do you agree with that, Danielle?
I agree. I certainly have spoken to a lot of borrowers, and I think I actually did profile one in the story that you referenced earlier, who did also start, was really close to finishing, had a child while he was in college, still stuck it out for 2 more years, and at some point made the decision that I have to go work to support my child, and left. And, you know, while his debt amount may be considered small relative to other people, I think he owes $31,000, this is someone who was striving to really try to make to better his situation, coming from a low-income family. And still, just because of the way the economics of higher ed works, could not get enough institutional aid or scholarships to help him finish that last semester. And I think he certainly could use the help and would be deserving of it.
Well, and we're up in a break here, but it just seems we have created such a complicated system, and you both are here to help us deconstruct it. And we are talking today in Radio Times about the announcement last week by President Biden to forgive certain amounts of federal student loan debt, and talking with Danielle Douglas Gabriel. She's national higher education reporter for The Washington Post. Also talking with Ron Lieber. He writes a column for The New York Times called Your Money and wrote a book called The Price You Pay for College. And we got a lot of people that want to join our conversation. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You can also call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Much more to talk about after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane talking with our guests about President Biden's student debt relief plan, who qualifies, how it will work, reactions to it, why college is so expensive. Well, here are some reactions to the announcement. They were strong. Most Democrats lauded the plan. Some said he didn't go far enough. Other questions whether it was the right solution. Republican politicians are talking about fairness to taxpayers, political plotting, and saying Biden overstepped his executive authority. And here's a montage.
I always said, with the flick of a pen, he could do it. Well, his pen flicked and he did it. He's eased the crushing burden of student loan debt for tens of millions of Americans, and we've got to keep going.
If you are that slacker barista who wasted 7 years in college studying completely useless things, now has loans and can't get a job, Joe Biden just gave you $20,000.
This is about America investing in people who work hard, who play by the rules, and who just need a government on their side.
Taxpayers that pay their bills and hardworking people, they shouldn't have to pay off the great big student loan debt for some college student that piled up massive debt going to some Ivy League school.
I think it was a bad decision. I think it was politically motivated. They're trying to buy votes.
The president did the right thing, and we have got to be really thinking about higher education in general. I don't hear any of these Republicans squawking when we give massive tax breaks to billionaires.
This is illegal. The president doesn't have the authority to do this. He's not an emperor. He can't just, with the stroke of a pen, cancel $300, $400 billion worth of student loan.
Ron, let me pick up on one of those voices there. That was Ted Cruz talking about the slacker barista who had spent 7 years, you know, wasted in college. There were a lot of trashing of people that took out these loans. And what do you make of that?
Well, I mean, where to start? Let's remember that, as we were discussing before the break, that there are all sorts of people in this population who were not able to finish school because school itself was not affordable in the first place because of a decline in state subsidies on the state university side or a lack of available grant aid. In the private institutions, right? Or they had to leave to take care of family members or leave during COVID, for safety reasons. A large number of borrowers are also people who went to graduate school, and they went to graduate school because they have to. Because they have to get the master's in teaching to educate our children, because they have to get the master's in social work to help kids in school who are troubled, or help grown-ups who need mental health or other assistance. And so to characterize the mass of borrowers in that way is, as I think we all know, an act of politics, not an act of policy substance.
Your thoughts, Danielle. And it was interesting that the White House went after some of their critics who had gotten PPP loans and put them out there saying, is that fair?
It was fascinating. I think the president really had a robust defense of his policy on the day this was announced. And it's telling that not only, as to Ron's point, are we talking about people who are underpin the infrastructure of our social system, right? So we're talking social workers, teachers. We're also talking firefighters, police officers, we're law enforcement. All those folks have to go through some form of post-secondary education. And I think they're often left out of the conversation, too. I've seen a lot of discussion about we are putting this on the backs of plumbers and electricians and other folks who are in those sorts of skilled trades. Well, there's a lot of skilled trade training that happens at community colleges. And so they're also a part of that discussion. And when I spoke to folks who were electricians, they acquired debt also as they were trying to do their training. So this is a broader population. The situation's far more nuanced than I think sometimes people give it credit for. So I'm glad to see, that we are having a broader conversation about who holds this debt.
Let me read an email from Warren, and Ron, I'll put it to you. Warren says, these loans are just like credit card loans. If you don't pay off enough, then the interest will kill you. What do people not understand about taking out a loan? And as the subtitle of your book says, I mean, this is one of the biggest expenses a person will ever have in their life, maybe besides a mortgage, figuring out how to pay for a college education. Are people just, they don't know how interest works?
Well, this gets to a larger question about what teenagers or other people who are starting their undergraduate educations, maybe as older students, in their 20s or 30s, getting started for the first time, how much do they really know about what it means to take on debt and the responsibilities that come with it and the consequences that come? Now, there is counseling that people are supposed to go through before they take out a federal loan. Mm-hmm. But the challenge is that when you start a program or the beginnings of an undergraduate education, you don't always know exactly how long it's going to take or how much you're going to need to borrow to get to the end. And so one of many challenges we have here in a system where we make people spend tens of thousands of dollars as opposed to just doing it for free the way that it happens in a lot of other countries is that it's actually hard to know what it is, what it's going to cost before it even starts. And, you know, if you're 18 or even 28, you may never have spent this much money before in your life, let alone borrowed this much. So it's kind of a lot to expect teenagers especially to understand what it is that they're signing up for if they have no experience with this kind of large number.
And Danielle, has the Biden administration created a kind of smooth way of getting rid of some of this debt, or is there mountains of paperwork awaiting someone who has, let's say, a Pell Grant and wants to figure out if they can get $20,000 reduced from their debt?
So I haven't seen the application yet. The Department of Education says that it will be out in mid-October. However, they are promising that it'll be a very short, very simple attestation of people's income. As far as, you know, whether or not they know who had a Pell Grant or not, the Department of Education has pretty extensive records on each and every borrower, everyone who ever received a federal grant. I could log in right now and look up my history and cry a little.
You owe some money?
How much money I took out from my... Well, I did pay off my loans recently, but I certainly did borrow quite a bit for my undergrad degree. Like many people, first gen, no resources, had no real options here. But you can find all of that information, and so can the department. So they, I imagine they will have a fairly easy time matching up people's records as to whether they were a Pell Grant recipient and how much debt cancellation they're entitled to as a result.
Did you have federal? Were you part of this federal program?
Oh yes, my parents had Parent Plus loans. I had Pell Grants. I had subsidized loans. I had private loans. Oh. We just were not really well. We weren't very knowledgeable. Plus, we just didn't have the money. So even with all the financial education in the world, it came down to resources and we didn't have it, so this was what my parents thought it was worth investing their time and money into. So I very much understand what families go through in these sorts of situations.
How long did it take to pay off all that debt?
18 years.
Wow.
18 years. Wow. In my 20s, I worked 5 jobs just to make sure that I could try to pay faster at one point, and still could not make it go away any faster than I'd hoped. But I don't regret my education. It was top notch.
Well, and thank you for sharing.
Yeah, so much.
No, I appreciate that. And thank you for sharing that. And Ron, if I can go back to you, I mean, this, you know, it seems to me we put Danielle in the spotlight here, but, you know, these are the people we want educated in this country, and yet we make it so hard for them.
We do, right? You know, there's this concept out there in public policy land known as administrative burden, right? And that's just a, you know, sort of a fancy or technical way of describing the obstacles that are in people's path and the hurdles they must clear to prove that they are deserving of assistance. And assistance here is defined broadly, right? Because what we see in a lot of financial aid packages when people try to go to school and figure out whether it's going to be affordable is that they get these so-called award letters from financial aid departments. And the award letters are often just invitations to take on 5 figures of debt each year, right? Between the kids and the parents. This is a problem that's not of, you know, current college administrators' creation. But the fact of the matter is that a fair number of, you know, 4-year undergraduate institutions simply are not affordable for the majority of Americans without taking on a whole bunch of debt. And that is a system that's not easy to fix just because President Biden flicks his pen.
And I do want to pick up on that, but let me just quickly reintroduce you. And we got a lot of comments here I want to read as well. That's Ron Lieber. He writes the Your Money column for the New York Times, and he also wrote a book called The Price You Pay for College. Danielle Douglas Gabriel is national higher education reporter for The Washington Post. We are talking about student debt. We are talking about Biden's plan announced last week to reduce some debt for some 40 million borrowers here in the United States. Let me read a couple of comments. Chris says, I graduated college without a single dime of debt, and I have no problem with people getting relief. Others I know who already paid off their debts feel the same. We should not be giving people a hard time about this. Ross says, as a non-college educated person who nets less than $35,000 a year, it doesn't seem fair that people who make up to $125,000 will get a $10,000 for free from the government. These people in this world trying to get by. Danielle, those are two, you know, opposing views on this program that the president announced last week. I don't think we'll ever resolve it, will we?
I doubt it. You know, I think this is a very sensitive subject to folks who perhaps wanted to go to college. Sure. And just made the decision for them that the expense of it was too much and they weren't going to burden themselves with debt. And I imagine we will continue to see this debate unfold over the next few months, especially as the potential of legal challenges to this policy start to emerge, which I suspect they will.
Is that because some are saying that the president really overstepped his bounds by using this executive order to get rid of some of this debt?
Yes, there are questions about the authority still, even though the president on the day of this announcement put out the legal memorandum that the Department of Education and Justice Department had been working on to show the authority that the president has to take this action. I still suspect there will be legal challenges.
Well, this is America, right? Nothing is settled ever, it seems. Ron, just assuming this stays in place, there's also a change in what percentage of income someone would be required to pay off their debt from 10% to 5%. What else do people need to know on that?
Sure. So to take a step back on that, there are a number of different ways that you can repay your federal student loan debt that depend on the amount of income that you have. And, you know, this is the part of the sort of never-ending complexity of these programs that amounts to a sort of Full Employment Act for personal finance journalists. But we're about to add another one. And basically the way it works at present is that if your income is low enough, you're only paying, 10 or 15% of your, sort of so-called discretionary income towards your debt each month, right? And so there's going to be this new form of repayment, layered on top of all the other ones that are possible, where under many circumstances, for many people, you will only pay 5% of your discretionary income. And the really good thing about this, if it comes to pass, is that the interest isn't going to increase in the background, right? Your balance isn't going to increase in the background because of the interest capitalizing if you're not able to make the full payment each month. So we don't know exactly when this is going to happen. It's going to take a while for it to be put into place. And there are these kind of third-party servicers that handle the payments for the federal government. Everybody's got to get on the same page. There need to be rules and regulations. But, you know, if it comes to pass, this may actually have more long-term impact on borrowers than, the $10,000 that disappears, at least on some future borrowers.
Well, that's fascinating. Danielle, you both have written about loan forgiveness. I mean, that there are things that people can do, or perhaps even jobs that people can have, that end up over time resulting in the forgiveness of a loan. What do people need to know about that?
Sure. There are lots of federal as well as state programs that are really designed to help public service workers more than anyone else. Public service loan forgiveness is probably the largest federal program. Has not worked to its full capacity since its inception. It's a pretty complicated program, and the Department of Education has proposed some rules to try to simplify a lot of things. There's currently a waiver that your listeners should know if they are working in the public sector, had been trying to achieve some forgiveness with this program. The department has a waiver right now that will give people credit for a lot of their payments that would not otherwise qualify. So very important to know. The deadline for that is October 31st. There are also lots of states. I think just about every state has at least one forgiveness program, usually geared towards public health care workers, social workers, police officers, firefighters, that if you make a commitment of 2 to 3 years in service, then in exchange for that, they will repay a percentage of your loans, sometimes all in some instances. So there are lots of ways that you can try to address this. And then, of course, as Ron mentioned, income-driven repayment plans. Mm-hmm. After 20, 25 years for the existing plans, then the debt that remains at the end of that term would be forgiven. But there is a tax liability on those programs, and I haven't seen that addressed in this latest one that is being pitched. And so I'm really curious to see how that's going to play out.
Yeah, Ron, anything you want to add to that?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, the tax thing is sort of confounding. So with public service loan forgiveness, if you have $100,000, $150,000, $200,000 in debt waived away, that does not become an income tax liability. Normally, forgiven debt is essentially added to your income and then you pay taxes on it. So it isn't happening with public service loan forgiveness. It's generally supposed to happen with this regular income-driven repayment debt forgiveness. It won't happen in the next couple of years because there was a provision of a big federal relief act a couple of years ago that waived the tax on forgiven debt for a couple of years. But there are some states that tax forgiven debt when they have state income taxes in those states. And so, it's a whole crazy quilt of complexity. Again, right? It's almost like you need the master's degree that you couldn't really afford to get in the first place to understand what the hell is going on here. And it's frustrating to try to explain it to people, and it's enormously frustrated to be in the position, where you're having to digest all of this and sort it out.
Well, I'm picking up on what Ron Lieber just said. What the hell is going on with our higher education system? Talking with Ron Lieber and Danielle Douglas Gabriel. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with our guests about President Biden's debt relief plan. We're talking a bit, and we'll talk some more about the higher cost of higher education and whether a college degree is all it is cracked up to be. And again, our guests are Danielle Douglas Gabriel, national higher education reporter for The Washington Post. Ron Lieber writes the Your Money column for The New York Times, wrote a book called The Price You Pay for College. And again, you can join us. Email us, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can pick up the phone and call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Let me talk more about the higher cost of college and universities. Danielle, let me begin with you. What are the main drivers? And when you look at how it has really outpaced inflation over the last 10 to 20 years, what's behind all that?
I think a good part of that is instructional costs, but I don't mean like professors with big salaries and such, but the entire support system and infrastructure that it takes to run a modern university at this stage. You've seen an increase in the addition of folks to address mental health issues, people to help with counseling and career counseling, people to help with student support services, as well as just, and that's an investment in healthcare. That's an investment in their overall compensation, and that has tended to drive up costs. But also at the same time with public institutions, you've seen a decline in state appropriations for many of these institutions. Community colleges, there are some states that don't contribute anything to their community college system. And all of that kind of stepping back and walking away from higher education means that the cost is shifted to the families. And so therefore, that tuition is a lever that colleges can use in order to offset the cost of delivering education. So you're seeing an increase in those prices as a result.
Yeah. Ron, you want to add to that?
Danielle nailed all the salient points there. The next notion that often comes up, right, is, well, why can't we figure out a way to offer a cut rate version of this? But if you're trying to offer a cut rate version of this to families with 18-year-olds who want to go to college immediately after high school, the question then becomes, you know, who is going to sort of willingly sign up for that cut rate version? And for better or for worse, families in America at, you know, the sort of middle class defined broadly level and above have come to see residential undergraduate higher education as almost a sort of, you know, sort of birthright or baseline or expectation. And so, you know, you talk to college presidents about this and they say, well, you know, your kids want to come live in the manner to which they've become accustomed in your household. And, you know, you want me to put them in tiny, you know, quad dorm rooms and have them in classrooms, you know, of 500 people and, you know, cut back on the mental health counseling, then you'll complain about that instead of about the cost, right? So, you know, what is it that we really want to pay for as parents and as families? And do we want our kids to be part of an experiment in bachelor's degrees at, you know, half of the current average cost? And if we are, maybe that will come to exist in the marketplace. But I'm not so sure as a parent myself that we do want to take that step. And that's part of the challenge.
Well, and Danielle, I mean, yes, a lot of students go to residential colleges and university living on campus, but a lot are commuters who go to Community College of Philadelphia or Temple University here. I'm a graduate of Temple University, and I commuted to that college. I mean, it seems to me that there are a lot of students who don't live on campus but end up with a lot of debt.
Certainly. I mean, yes, the portion of room and board in the overall cost of attendance is significant. But even if someone's not living on campus, they still have to live. And that may be paying rent off of campus, right? That even if you're staying at home with your parents, you still have to commute. Transportation costs are expensive for a lot of students, particularly low-income students who don't have those sorts of resources. So there are lots of other ways that folks can start to acquire and accumulate debt as a result of their education. Staying home and being a commuter may certainly make your overall cost a lot lower than someone who remains on campus, but you still have to be able to cover your living expenses. And I've encountered a lot of students who still have to figure out how to pay for that. And that becomes sometimes the thing that undermines their education because they have to work and they end up having to work so much that it starts to interfere with their education.
Ron, have states sort of disinvested in higher education?
Well, if you're in a situation like just about all of the states were in, you know, 2008 and 2009, where it really did seem like the economy was going over the waterfall entirely, you know, you have some difficult choices to make about where you cut in the budget. And cutting the subsidies that were given to the state university systems effectively, you know, sort of push difficult choices off on, you know, sort of to the chancellor and the university presidents and the administrators who make budgets. Because at that point, they can either cut jobs or they can raise tuition. And when they raise tuition, some of those tuition hikes can be absorbed by people, you know, just taking on more debt. right? And so if you're a politician and you're thinking about where can I make the cuts where they will have the least amount of political impact and individuals can borrow to, you know, what feels like lessen some of that impact, that sort of feels like a reasonable and maybe the, you know, the easiest choice to make when you have to make tough decisions. Unfortunately, you know, those subsidies haven't been restored in many instances, you know, in the amounts that they were cut when times were tougher.
Let me read a couple of more comments. One from Denny. He says, this is a one-time cash giveaway to a lucky slice of the population. It leaves my three children out, all of whom are college grads with no debt because they worked through college and saved every spare bit of money, which was not easy. Another email, although the student loan programs aren't structured as indentured servitude, the net effect for many borrowers ends up being the same. Another comment, what is spending money on a quote-unquote useless degree? My blood boils hearing politicians say that philosophy is used in English and law and communication in these politicians' staff. Marketing, is that useless? I mean, it seems, Danielle, that this just has tapped into so much resentment out there. And maybe this is just the world that we live in or the times that we live in is a kind of a zero sum game that if you get something, then I lose out.
It is pretty remarkable. I mean, I've heard so many arguments in the last week or so from people who say, look, I don't have kids. I pay into a system that affords for public school. I don't see how this is any different. Or folks who say, I have never received food stamps. However, happy to assure that other people who need them can do it. But somehow this, and I think in part of that is because we're talking about people who have higher education, who, you know, ostensibly should be able to have higher earning potential than the average American, it kind of changes the tenor of the conversation some.
Well, and picking up on that higher earning potential question, Ron, do most people who get, let's say, a 2-year or 4-year degree, do they make more money than a high school graduate?
They do. But again, they have to finish, right? And there is a large minority of people who don't. They end up with debt, and they don't get the income boost. But the fact of the matter is that if you do finish, you know, the sort of best economic data that we have over time for 4-year degrees suggests, you know, something like a $1 million swing over a lifetime in terms of the amount of extra income that you earn. Where this gets confusing is, you know, you have people talking about the, you know, sort of liberal arts degrees, for lack of a better description. You caught some of the undercurrent of that in the sort of, you know, sneering that that Senator Cruz did about what some folks study. But the fact of the matter is that people who get those degrees, they don't earn as much right out of school. But those folks, more often than not, do catch up to the computer science majors by mid-career for a whole bunch of reasons we don't have to get into. So yes, college does pay off on average over time. But there are lots of people who fall, you know, sort of below that average line, particularly right out of school. And so, you know, the conversation we have in public about that gets, you know, confusing and sometimes contentious.
Here's another comment, and Danielle, I'll put this to you. This is from Edward. He says, for every dollar taxpayers absorb in forgiveness, the colleges, universities, and banks should match it. These institutions benefited from overselling to uninformed people with promises they could not fulfill. We've touched on some of that during the hour, but Edward summarizes that pretty succinctly. What are your thoughts?
Certainly, accountability has to be a part of any reform to the federal lending system, and accountability has to be looking at how schools are educating students, and I guess the value of the education and the outcomes in terms of, are people graduating? Are people graduating with excessive amounts of debt that they'll never be able to pay back? And you're seeing some of that captured in the gainful employment rules. This is a regulation squarely aimed at career training, which happens at community colleges, but oftentimes for-profit institutions as well. Now, there isn't exactly a matching component of that is broadly looking at public and private nonprofit education. And there's some people who think that it should. But the other issue I think the Biden administration has been promoting is transparency. The College Scorecard, which is run by the Federal Department of Education, gives folks a sense of if you study this thing at this school, what are your chances of having X amount of earnings in 5 years, 10 years? And there's more information coming into that system that should be useful to borrowers and their families. I did want to mention one thing. I mean, certainly the benefits of a college degree are pretty remarkable. However, there are racial disparities in that benefit. You know, I think it would be remiss not to mention that Black borrowers, as much as even when they graduate, still have higher rates of delinquency, higher rates of default, still oftentimes find themselves having to pursue an advanced degree in order to be on comparable to a white borrower with a bachelor's degree in terms of their earning potential. So labor market discrimination still exists, and some of that underpins what we're seeing here in terms of low wealth resources for different populations within the borrowing population.
No, I'm glad you raised that. It's such an important point. Ron, do you think this forgiveness plan from the Biden administration will drive up the costs of higher education, in that maybe colleges, universities can say, well, you know, we can charge more since people will have this debt forgiveness? Does it work that way?
It depends. I mean, what are we talking about when we talk about higher education? I think the biggest danger, you know, in terms of the potential circumstance that you describe, is at certificate programs and for-profit institutions where they are working with undergraduate students who are independent, right? So they can borrow something like $57,000 from the federal student loan program. This isn't for graduate school, but for other types of programs, as opposed to undergraduates who are still dependents vis-a-vis their parents or others' tax returns, right? So that $57,000 goes a long way if you are an institution providing a program that maybe doesn't cost $57,000 to provide. It could be tempting in those circumstances to raise your rates and encourage people just to max out their loans because, you know, maybe they'll only have to pay back that, you know, 5% of their discretionary income over time, and then it'll just go away. And it would be pretty easy to, you know, convince an impressionable teenager or somebody who's 32 who's desperate to, you know, acquire an additional credential to just borrow to the hilt, thinking that, well, you know, loan cancellations already happened once, and I know about this 5% thing, and this is going to be affordable for me, so I'll just borrow, you know, whatever they tell me to. So is there a possibility in those kinds of programs where this could happen? Yeah, I think it's not zero.
Well, Danielle, I'm looking at the clock here, but I'm also remembering back during the last presidential campaign, there were some candidates talking about free college or university education, maybe at the community college level or maybe even beyond that. Is there any chance that this will happen in the United States of America?
I think it might. I mean, certainly we are further along in this discussion of free community college than we have ever been. Oh. There, it was a actual proposal within the Build Back Better plan that did not succeed. However, there was a lot of support for this idea, so I would not be surprised to see it reemerge in Congress anytime soon. I also think it's worth noting that there are about 30 states that currently have some form of a tuition-free college promise program offering free tuition at the community college level, and in some instances at the public four-year level, like New York and a few other places. So this isn't outside of the realm of possibility. I think we can get there.
Well, a lot of really good and important information during this hour of Radio Times. Danielle Douglas, Gabriel, thank you for joining us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And she's national higher education reporter for The Washington Post. Ron Lieber, thank you for joining us as well.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
You're very welcome. He writes the Your Money column for the New York Times, and his most recent book is titled The Price You Pay for College. To replay this hour, many more hours of Radio Times, go to WHYY.org and look for Radio Times under programs. You can also download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you for joining us.